And welcome now to the midday for a Tuesday. I'm Norman Gilliland in our Buck studio, and that just about always means live music from either local or Wisconsin area musicians or those whom we capture on their way through town. So today we have the Rhapsody Quartet, that's R-H-E-P-S-O-D-I-E, and their members include Suzanne Bia and Laura Burns and Christopher Dazost and Carl Levine. And welcome, one and all.
Thanks.
And I want to first find out about this concept of the Rhapsody Quartet. Is that a creature of the Madison Symphony, or is it you just happen to all perform in the Madison Symphony?
It's actually a creation of the Madison Symphony, and our full name, I think, is the Rhapsody String Quartet of the Heartstrings Community Engagement Program of the Madison Symphony.
Why don't you just go with that all the time?
It gets a little unwieldy, so sometimes I'm even confused what our name is.
But, informally,
we call ourselves the Heartstrings Quartet, and then we're the Rhapsody Quartet.
Okay. And so where does the heartstrings come into this thing? This is Suzanne speaking, by the way.
Hi. The heartstrings comes into play because it's a program that was envisioned by Rick Mackey and instituted by the Madison Symphony, where a small group of ambassadors, that would be us, bring music to special needs communities at places where it might not be so easy for people to get to a concert to hear us or to hear the symphony. So we come to them. We play in centers for the developmentally disabled. We play in schools where maybe a high proportion of the children are special needs. We play in a lot of assisted care facilities and facilities for Alzheimer's patients and such.
So how many of these performances do you do in a course of a year? Sounds like quite a few.
Close to 100, I think.
You're kidding.
No.
Wow. So this would be number 101.
Well, we haven't gotten there yet. But yeah, we have one program for every month, September through May, and we visit between 10 and 12 locations each month and repeat. So we're visiting a location 9 times over the course of a year.
Same
location. We establish a relationship. So today, for example, we'll be playing later on at the Scollin Retirement Home in Stoughton, where we've been, I guess that would be 5 times already this year.
And how are the responses? Does it take a while to build up sometimes interest in people who are not that accustomed to hearing a string quartet? How does that work?
Well, I think it depends greatly on the venue and on what the individual requirements of that facility are. I think the fact that we're a string quartet speaks to people pretty immediately, but it's just how cognitively able are they and how... And I like to think that even in cases where we can't tell that there's a rapport being built and a connection being made, that there in fact is, and that we're adding a quality of life that in some cases they wouldn't get if we didn't come.
It's not always immediately obvious what the reaction of the audience is or what they're getting out of it, but long term.
In some cases, they don't necessarily applaud at the end of a piece or whatever, but we watch for more subtle signs, like somebody perking up their head that had been just having their head down previously, or somebody maybe subtly tapping their foot in time to the music. And
yeah, that must be very gratifying.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, you have selected today a nice variety of performances, and starting with one, though, that I'm trying to remember if by the time we get to Beethoven's Opus 127, people thought he was crazy, or if it was not until Opus 135, but getting up there, I guess, in some cases.
Oh, I think the middle period works shocked a few people already. So yeah, this is Opus 127, the first movement. It was written in 1825. It's sort of the first of his late quartets, as they're called, and I think he was sort of stepping away from the drama and the struggle of the middle period and looking more inward. The movement we're going to play is in sort of a very, very loose sonata form, but the first and second themes have been replaced by two different contrasting sections, alternating maestoso and allegro sections. They come in 3 key areas, E-flat, G major and C major, and finally works its way back to E flat.
Okay, so first movement of the Beethoven Opus 127, Rhapsody Quartet. Well, it sounds perfectly elegant today. I don't hear a crazy note in there. That's the first movement of the Beethoven Opus 127 String Quartet, as performed in our Buck Studio live today by the Rhapsody Quartet. Suzanne Bia and Lauren Burns are the violinists. The violist is Christopher Dazorst, and the cellist is Carl Levine, all of them members of the Madison Symphony, and all of them play to some extent with the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra also, and of course, all over the place. 100 concerts a year is the Rhapsody Quartet.
Yeah, the sessions that we do are generally short. They're between 50 minutes and an hour, so you can squeeze a couple of them in a day.
Yeah, I suppose so, with a little traveling time in there. Well, speaking of traveling and a change of scene, it often works to a composer's advantage to have a little different thing to look at, a little different culture, and it certainly worked for Dvorak, but there is still some debate, some of it fueled by the composer himself, as to how American his American works are, but he certainly wrote some masterpieces back in the 1890s during his sojourn in New York and in Iowa, and one of them is his famous American Quartet. What do you think about the American Quartet? Does it sound Czech to you, or does it sound American, or does it not matter?
Oh, I think there's definitely elements of both. You can't take the Czech out of Dvorak. It's not possible, but... Yeah, this one was written in 1893 during his time in Spillville, Iowa. He had been teaching in New York at a school and making a very good salary, but there was an economic downturn and the school lost a lot of its funding, so eventually they sort of just stopped paying him, and he was forced to take his family elsewhere for a while. So he went to Spillville, where he found a little, community of fellow Czech expatriates, and did a lot of really productive time there in terms of composition. He composed the very famous New World Symphony, and then right after that he composed this one, the American Quartet, which I think it definitely has many, many identifiable American influences, and from, I guess, what at the time were called Negro spirituals, which find their way into this, to the opening of this last movement that we're going to play, the Vivace Mon Antropo, fourth movement, which opens with maybe what has been speculated to be the Native American drumming.
We know that pattern. He saw Native Americans performing dances and singing.
Yeah, and in the third movement, which we won't be playing, but it's very specifically spelled out that the motive in there, bum-ba-da-da-da-dum, was the motive of the little American bird that he heard, Eastern Tohi, that he heard outside his room every day. So many, many influences from America.
In the American Quartet by Dvorak, and this is the finale played by the Rhapsody Quartet. Thank you. Brings them to their feet. One of those really exciting, dramatic, and engaging string quartets. That was the finale of the American Quartet by Antonin Dvorak, played in our Bach studio today by the Rhapsody Quartet. And so you all must have played that a great number of times, right? Do you have a sense that over the course of time your performance of it has changed any? And if so, how? Tapped into something.
Anyone else
here
want to take that
question,
one? I don't know. I mean, we're always evolving, and it's hard even to remember because the evolution is so gradual that I can't remember what it was like when we first played this 9-10 years ago. But I do remember trying out different things, and we'll go through a phase where we're like, oh, let's do this section a little slower, and then we're like, no, let's not do that anymore. So I'm not sure. It evolves, but not in a way that probably any of us can actually quantify.
What about the fifth member of the quartet, known as the audience? Does that have an effect on the way you play these things, tempo or
sure,
dynamics?
Sure, yeah, and of course, as does the room that we're in.
Sure.
Maybe just adjusting for different, like the studio is maybe not the most resonant of the places we've ever played, so.
Oh, we can fix that later, Suzanne.
We're free to go a little faster. We're, you know, I don't know if that answers your question.
Sure, no, absolutely. Yeah, there are a lot of variables, and time is probably the biggest of them, the way these things would change over the course of time, even in the same studio or a performing hall. And now back to the Rhapsody Quartet here in our Bach studio. And we've heard Beethoven so far and Dvorak, and now we're going to move solidly into the 20th century with Dmitri Shostakovich, who wrote, 15 string quartets course of time. And they, as you would imagine, vary considerably. A couple of them are extremely accessible, and others are requiring a little bit more attention, you might say. So what do you have, Suzanne? What have you brought today?
Oh, this is part of the string quartet number 8. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to add about the 15 quartets that I think he set out to write one in every key. So theoretically, we would have had 24. He never quite finished the project.
That's a tall order.
But the ones we have are each in a different key. There's no duplication there, so.
What about number 8?
Our 8th quartet is in C minor. It was written over a span of 3 days, July 12th through 14th, 1960. And the composer had been touring Dresden and seeing all the destruction around him, still left over from the war, buildings bombed out, empty spaces that presumably represented, you know, thousands of lives lost. And So he wrote this quartet, and its official dedication is in memory of the victims of fascism and war. But then later there's a quote from Shostakovich that says, I reflected that if I die someday, it's hardly likely that anyone will write a work dedicated to my memory, so I decided to write one myself. And that's this eighth quartet. And you can tell it's autobiographical because at every turn, his little monogram, the DSCH of his signature is, well, it's basically what the quartet is based on. It's what it opens with. Yeah, Shostakovich's signature motive.
Listen for that.
Again and again and again. So the work is about 24 minutes long, and we didn't really have time to do all of it today, and it flows from one movement into the next, so it's a little tricky to break up, and I feel a little bad about that, but we're going to do the first two movements and just take you a little bit into the third, and that'll
leave us wanting more.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Movements 1 and 2, plus 3 measures of the third movement of Shostakovich's 8th String Quartet, played by the Rhapsody String Quartet here in our Buck studio. Well, we promised something completely different, but, you know, string quartet works really well for this dance music.
Yes.
And it was often performed that way, much more portable.
Hmm.
And what are you going to be doing? I'm not familiar with this particular piece, Suzanne.
Oh, I think
Strauss.
You are. You just aren't familiar with it in a string quartet transcription. But this is from Johann Strauss Jr.'s operetta Die Fledermaus.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
And it's called the Watch Duet. I won't attempt the German pronunciation. The story, very briefly, is that Mr. Eisenstein was something of a philanderer, and he had a little special watch that made a little dinging sound. It was called a repeater watch, very cool and popular back in the day, probably like an iPhone is now or something, I don't know. But he loved to use it to charm the ladies. And he went to a costume party, and he spotted a woman across the room and sauntered over and brought out his little pocket watch and started flirting, and the conversation went on. And what he realized only a little too late is that the woman he was seducing was his wife in disguise. So this is just a little excerpt. This is from some of the music that we do at our heartstrings sessions. So very fun, the Watch Duet.
Johann Strauss.
Thank you.
always tells you something when the musicians are smiling when they play. The Watch Duet from Fledermaus by Johann Strauss the Younger. And without much further ado, this particular song seems to have been rediscovered in recent years from the works of Dvorak and has really taken off again in popularity, the Song of the Moon.
Yeah, absolutely. Probably due in large part, I think, to Renee Fleming.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of her favorites, and certainly one of my favorites. It's called The Song to the Moon from Rusalka by Dvorak, which is his opera. It contains actually a lot of really good music, and it's too bad it's not more frequently performed, but I guess not enough singers specialize in Czech or something.
That's a trick, yeah.
Anyway, this is Rusalka's Song to the Moon. She has fallen in love with Rusalka, I should say, is a water, what do you say, water nymph, water sprite, mm-hmm. and she's fallen in love with a mortal, a prince, and...
Hate it when that happens.
I know. It never works.
Prelude to disaster.
And it doesn't really work in this case either. But she hasn't learned that yet, and she's very optimistic, and she's looking up at the full moon one night, and she says a little prayer to the moon and says, oh, please somehow shine down on the prince and let him know how much I love him.
Here it is. Well, you can see from that how it's why it's caught on. Some gorgeous melodies in there, and Dvorak did have a way with a melody. And that was The Song of the Moon from the opera Rusalka by Dvorak and performed by the Rhapsody Quartet. And let's see now, what's the term you use, Suzanne, for the Rhapsody Quartet? It's official.
The Rhapsody Quartet of the Heartstrings Community Engagement Program of the Madison Symphony Orchestra.
Okay, set it in a nutshell there. And before you take off, all of you, what are you up to individually? Now, I know that, let's see, some of you are playing with the Madison Symphony, and that's going to be Stephen Huff next week, right?
That's right, and currently we're doing the Madison Opera, which has its performances this coming weekend, Friday and Sunday. And that is an opera called Charlie Parker's Yardbird.
Oh, sure. Yes, I've heard about that.
By Schneider. And it's lots of fun, combining jazz and classical in kind of a unique way.
Laura Burns, what's on your plate? She's the second violinist.
I'm looking forward to the Tchaikovsky, which will happen with the Madison Symphony in a couple weeks. So...
says which Tchaikovsky?
Six.
I know it's Peter Tchaikovsky, but the sixth, the symphony, symphony number six. Okay, yes, of course, a crowd pleaser for sure. Mm-hmm. And Carl Levine, who was providing all that great pizzicato in the Rusalka just now, Song of the Moon.
Well, just the same as Suzanne and Chris, who were, you know, Yardbird coming up this weekend and symphony the next weekend and then on to chamber orchestra after that.
We see a lot of each other.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
We stop at saying too much.
Yeah.
And Chris?
Yeah, I'm very much in the same boat. I'm also very much looking forward to getting through the week and performing this opera, and then we just dive right in with the symphony program, and then, yeah, chamber orchestra after that, and at some point, a night off, perhaps.
That's right. Chamber Orchestra are doing the Brahms Violin Concerto, so that's,
yes,
among other things. So that's a handful for everybody, too. But you wouldn't want too many nights off, not as a musician. Well, again, thanks one and all for performing here as the Rhapsody Quartet. It's been a real treat having you. We look forward to seeing you at one venue or the other. You're playing again in Stoughton, you say, soon. Later today?
Yes.
Later today, so soon.